Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey there, listeners. Every Sunday through the midterm elections in November, my friend from the WNYC and Gothamist newsroom, Bridget Bergen, will be hosting a call-in show that explores the power dynamics of New York's political landscape. And every Sunday, you can hear the podcast of that show here. So now, this week's edition of The People's Guide to Power.
This is The People's Guide to Power. I'm your host, Bridget Bergen, a senior reporter in the WNYC and Gothamist newsroom. This is our new midterm election series that brings people with power together with those who seek it, the journalists that cover it, and you. On today's show, we're talking about the power of the 6th borough. And if that made you pause for a moment and say, hey, Bridget, there are only 5 boroughs in New York City, let me explain. Actually, let's have Mayor Eric Adams.
We don't say it lightly that Puerto Rico is the 6th borough of New York City. We mean it, and we're going to continue to be committed to this.
That was just last weekend. Adams led a delegation to Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic to survey the damage left by Hurricane Fiona. While, of course, it is not officially the 6th borough, that honorary title speaks to the deep relationship between our region and the island. New York is home to one of the largest populations of Puerto Ricans on the mainland of the United States. There are more than 1.5 million Puerto Ricans in New York and New Jersey. And the all-too-familiar images of rising floodwaters and wind-strewn streets 5 years, almost to the day, after Hurricane Maria devastated the island, are re-traumatizing people here in our region again with family and friends there, along with those living there themselves. Here's Karina, who called into the Brian Lehrer Show a couple days after the storm hit.
I've been hearing from my family that they don't have any clean running water right now. Same from my friends, close friends. They don't have electricity or running water, and my partner and I have a house in the west side of the island, and that part we haven't been able to communicate with our neighbors to even see if our house is okay. But the little that we have heard is that the roads are completely blocked by debris and by trees, and that they have barely any cell phone communications. And that the rivers have risen and there's a lot of flooding.
Like we're seeing today in the devastating scenes of destruction in Florida and South Carolina after another storm, Hurricane Ian made landfall there last week, we are faced with the question of how to help our fellow Americans recover from this devastation, a point public advocate Jumani Williams underscored earlier this week.
When it comes to Puerto Rico, somehow, as mentioned, people forget that these are Americans. These are Americans. What other state would this happen in that the entire country would not galvanize everything they can to make sure that it's happening okay?
So what is our government doing to help Puerto Rico? President Biden is scheduled to tour the island tomorrow before traveling to Florida to survey the damage left by Hurricane Ian. Not surprisingly, New York elected officials are also sending support in the form of boots on the ground, as well as food, water, and other resources. Last week, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand sent a letter to President Biden seeking billions in aid for the island. At an event on Monday, she was joined by Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez, a trailblazer who was the first Puerto Rican woman elected to Congress in 1992 and has represented portions of Brooklyn ever since. Velazquez says she warned federal officials a year ago that the island's infrastructure was still too vulnerable to potential storms. While the U.S. announced a plan earlier this year to invest $12 billion to modernize Puerto Rico's electrical grid, shifting to 100% renewable energy by 2050, she says the people living there need help now, pounding on the podium to make her point.
My family lives there. This is why I am here today. This is why some people, maybe in the administration, previous administration or this administration, might say that I'm a pain in the neck. But I'm not going away. We have a moral obligation. We, the federal government, has a colony in the Caribbean. And therefore, with that comes responsibility.
A responsibility to the Americans and to their friends and families and voters here. So on today's show, we're going to talk about the power of the sixth borough and the Latino leadership more broadly here in our region, and we want to hear from you. Do you have friends or family in Puerto Rico or the Dominican Republic? How are they recovering from this latest storm, and does their experience inform how you evaluate candidates running for office in our region? Joining us now to talk more about the close connection between New York and Puerto Rico is Bronx State Senator Gustavo Rivera, who was born and raised on the island and is an outspoken advocate for his community here in New York and in Albany. Senator Rivera, welcome back to WNYC.
It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. This afternoon, I should say. This afternoon.
Yeah.
It's 12 after 12.
And Senator, we started today's show with that clip of Mayor Adams in Puerto Rico talking about the sixth borough. So I was wondering, can you talk about that idea? Why would someone call Puerto Rico the sixth borough?
Well, I think that there's a deep connection between Puerto Ricans here in the United States period, but certainly in New York. It was one of the places that Puerto Ricans started when they left the island and they came to the U.S. to work, to prosper, to look for a better future for themselves. Many of them came to New York. They've been established here for a while. The political power structure, as far as Latinos are concerned, Puerto Ricans were kind of the first to break through. There are many of us who have, some of us, I've been in office for just over a decade. There's folks that have been in office for decades or have been around for decades. So there's a deep connection between folks there and here. That has always been the case, and I don't necessarily envision that changing anytime soon.
And what is your take on trips like the one we just talked about? You know, visiting the island after disaster, do they help bring real visibility to what's needed there? We talked about how President Biden is traveling there tomorrow. I know you made some trips with former Governor Cuomo after Hurricane Maria, right?
I did, but I also traveled on my own. The first thing I'll say as far as many of these trips certainly bring an attention to the plight of folks wherever disasters strike is a positive thing. I'm always weary of big, you know, trips with elected officials and what have you. My concern first is, what is this going to soak resources from the island when it's most needed? It's why I was a couple of years ago when Maria happened. We canceled. There's a Somos conference. I'm sure mm-hmm. you've spoken about it, right? There's a conference that happens every November in Puerto Rico. That is a follow up to a conference that happens in March or April in Albany. A lot of New York folks go down to Puerto Rico. It got canceled because if there's too many resources that are used for people that are not, you know, that are not there to help, that's mm-hmm. that's really concerning. But I did travel there with Governor Cuomo, but I did travel by myself and with one staffer back in March of 2018, and just traveled around to different parts of the island, Humacao, Loíza, Ponce, Comerío, where my parents are from, as well as San Juan, to kind of get a sense on the ground from the organizations that were that actually were, you know, they had already had a presence on the ground, and then they transformed themselves to serve people immediately after the crisis, right after the storm. Mm-hmm. So I've certainly done a lot of traveling down there post storms.
And it sounds like what you're saying is it helps inform your ability to answer that question: how can we help?
Because precisely. And one thing I would say is that there is, I think that what we need to do from outside, and this is speaking of somebody who was born and raised there. I no longer live there. I have friends who are there. Most of my immediate family has moved to Florida now. But I think that our priority needs to be, how do we, this is, Maria taught me this, how do we find organizations on the ground, Puerto Rican-led organizations that have a presence on the ground, that have credibility on the ground, that are already have been doing work of both power building literally, like the one that comes to mind immediately is Casa Pueblo in Adjuntas, that has been doing like quite literally building power structures. They actually, during Maria, they were one of the places because they had a solar power infrastructure that they had been building for over a decade. They were one of the only places on the island that was immediately able to have power back on immediately. Hmm. And they're also building power in people, because they are built by Puerto Ricans for Puerto Ricans and have an agenda that is beyond just disaster relief. And you know, for the long-term benefit of the island, that's what we have to do. We find organizations that are doing work on the ground that are Puerto Rican led. Let's not, you know, and New Yorkers, you know, Americans certainly have this penchant sometimes, and certainly New Yorkers, because we, you know, we're New Yorkers, right? We know better than some people. So sometimes we might fly somewhere and we might go somewhere and be like, well, we know better. Nah, no, let's relax with that. Hmm. The folks who are doing work on the ground, they might know better. Let's give them resources so they can just expand what they're already doing on the ground.
I want to shift the conversation back to our region. For years, Puerto Ricans made up the largest share of the city's Latino community. Now it's Dominicans, and obviously there are so many other groups that make up the broader Latino community. But can you talk a little bit about some of the dynamics at play between Puerto Ricans and this broader Latino community? You know, I've heard you describe it as immigrants without the immigrant experience.
In the case of Puerto Ricans, there's a big difference between the Puerto Rican community and any other Latin American country. You know, whether it's Dominican Republic, Mexico, you know, any Central American country, Honduras or Guatemala, etc. We are citizens by birth. When we are born in Puerto Rico, like I was a citizen by birth, and then when I came to New York, I came originally in 1998 to do a degree in political science. I didn't have to do anything regarding immigration. There's a lot of experiences that I never had to deal with, and generations before us, there were definitely parts of the experience that they had to deal with, but there was the whole angle about not having citizenship that we've never had to deal with, right? Mm-hmm. So it was a little bit easier. Even in the racist political times in which Puerto Ricans broke through, it was a little easier because we didn't have to deal with the citizenship issue. Mm-hmm. But I would say that there's been, so over the years, as communities have grown, and certainly the Dominican community is a perfect example, I think is the best example, they have grown not only numerically, but more generations have been born here. There have been, you know, they've kind of broken through and established themselves politically. But there has been a challenge to develop kind of a broader, you know, pan-Latino agenda, for mm-hmm. lack of a better term. And that's been a difficult thing. And it's something that I've been, as somebody who now finds myself, and it's a little bit weird for me to say this, but I am one of the most senior Latinos in the entire state legislature. I don't know how it happened, but, you know, here I am 12 years later after being elected. There's a term, padrino, right? Godfather, right? The way that many people got into politics is somebody, you know, kind of throws their arm over them and says like, hey, I'm going to bring you in, etc. And certainly in Latino circles for a long time, that's just how it happened. You know, you were in a circle, you were either a family member of an elected or a friend of an elected, and where you just were in the circle, and all of a sudden you got elected to a little district leadership or city council, etc. I kind of came in completely outside of that by sheer luck and hard work, but then found myself, now it's 12 years later, I'm you know, I'm one of the most senior members, and I'm kind of like scratching my head and being like, how can we actually address this? How can we actually build a broader Latino agenda? And it's difficult sometimes when you have a lot of folks kind of fighting for their own fiefdoms in different places.
Senator Rivera, you started to get into this idea of, you know, whether achieving elected office can then translate into broader community civic engagement. I'm wondering, from your perspective, you know, how does that translate within the Puerto Rican community? I mentioned Congresswoman Velasquez earlier, first Puerto Rican woman elected in 1992. And of course, there's also Congressman Adriano Espaillat, the first Dominican elected, but not until 2016. Has the ability to achieve elected office translated into real engagement?
I mean, depends how you define engagement. Mm. I certainly think both of these folks are history makers. Both Congressmember Velasquez and Congressmember Espaillat are both history makers. I certainly can say that both are friends, and I look up to Congresswoman Velasquez quite a bit since she's been a luchadora for a long time. In Espaillat, we served together in the Senate, and now we overlap with each other. He is my Congress member. When I thought about it, took me a second to think about. But as far as civic engagement, it sometimes does and it sometimes does not. We do the work in our particular communities to make sure that we get reelected. And certainly they both have been successful in doing that. And at times there's some of us who at times put more effort into civically engaging people beyond elections. That's not always successful, and kind of the everyday, vagaries of politics, if you will, make it so that we don't, that's not necessarily something that we are encouraged to do. It just depends how you define, engagement, I guess.
Sure. You used the word, you talked about the kind of the struggle against people focused on their own fiefdoms. And you are certainly someone who has operated outside of, as you talked about the way you got into politics, you are, I think, fair to describe it as outside of the Bronx machine.
that is certainly a fair assessment.
So I'm wondering if you want to kind of elaborate a little bit on what you mean when you say kind of the way power has developed through this kind of model of sort of individual, locuses of power.
Yeah, over the years, for the first thing we need to talk about is nepotism. And this is certainly not just for the Latino or the Puerto Rican community, but it's how when I started to do, when I started to do politics, be a political operative or work in government, you saw the fact that, whether it was the Riveras up here, Rivera is like the Smith of the Puerto Ricans. So I am not related to these folks, but the Riveras up here. In one point, there was a council member, an assembly member, that crossed over, there was a daughter, a father, and a son. Then there was then the Diazes in the South Bronx, the Arroyos in the South Bronx, the Delans in Brooklyn, and I don't necessarily have an issue with these folks, and sometimes I've had fights with some of them, and sometimes I've been allies with some of them, but it just was clear to me, the Espadas certainly, that the back of which I broke back in 2010. All of these folks, they established their own little power structure. They got their family members or friends elected, and for good or ill, it never developed into a broader Latino agenda. Right? It was all about how do we actually get folks elected, and that's folks elected that are family members or our friends. I have a real issue with nepotism because it completely stunts any type of real leadership building. And then you extend it to an immediate circle of friends who are just like, they're folks who are loyal to that particular structure. That doesn't build broader power. And that means that then policy conversations are shifted to the side and sometimes just ignored, that's kind of the issue. This is about power power building needs to build towards something, and it needs to build toward how do we use our power to actually change policy for the better. And these kind of fiefdoms didn't necessarily lend themselves to that.
I want to go to one of our callers. Let's go to John in West New York, New Jersey. John, thanks for holding and welcome to WNYC and the People's Guide to Power.
Thank you. I really like the subject, but let me begin by saying that this kind of problem has been going on in Puerto Rico like forever. They never have a good electrical system because it doesn't take a hurricane for people to get their electrical system shut off. They get that almost every week for whatever reasons. I don't understand. But they keep putting money into something that is not working, and they just passing up the problem. And the government had to take more action for themselves. They can't expect people to come from another, say, for the mainland, to pour money into the system, to try to fix the system, to take control of the system, because that's worsening the situation. They had to take control. They had to say, wait, this is an island. We need a different system. This system is not the same one as in New York, because New York is not an island. We're going to keep getting hurricanes and like forever. Maybe every year we're going to get them. And every 4 or 5 years, there's going to be something like Maria. But they have to take control, and they don't have to wait for Washington. They have enough money during the 2017 hurricane to fix the system, but they squandered the money. And I'm Puerto Rican, and I got family there. But there's something wrong. There's something wrong with it.
John, thank you so much for your call. Senator, go ahead. I can tell you how to respond to that.
If I may. So the thing is that what I would respond here is that there are folks who are doing that. I mean, when I mentioned Casa Pueblo, and I would encourage anyone who's listening who does not know these folks, casapueblo.org, go and look them up and look at some of the work that they've been doing. They have been figuring out how to, outside of the grid, build resiliency and power, not only in the people there, but in power systems. And they've been trying to get the type of work that they do to build power systems that are outside of the grid, that are resilient, that are, you know, that are renewable. They've been trying to do it. But see, what we cannot ignore is that there are, and it was said that the Congress member Velasquez said it in the clip that you played. We have a colony of the United States in Puerto Rico, and we have a colony of the United States, and colonies by definition are about extraction. And so what happened, for example, with the power system that was publicly owned before it was purchased and privatized by LUMA, was a power system that, yes, had a lot of issues, but because it was a public system, there were ways to actually hold it accountable in ways that we can't do with a private system. On top of that, what you saw over years was, and the Republicans, and certainly, let's just be honest, like conservatives and capitalists, are quite interested in making systems that are publicly owned seem inefficient, so that then they could just say, well, the private system will fix it. And then they just, it's flipped over to privatization. That is the way that it works, right? You show, quote unquote, that public systems, publicly accountable systems don't work, like utility companies, for example, in this case. And then you flip it over to a private company, which is what happened with LUMA. And as we've seen, they're actually not only like more exploitative than ever, because it's more the power there is more expensive than it ever was under the public power authority, but it's actually less efficient and less effective.
State Senator, I want to jump in there. I'm sorry, we have to take a short break. You're listening to The People's Guide to Power on WNYC. I'm your host, Bridget Bergen. Stay tuned. We have more of your calls coming up. More from Bronx State Senator Gustavo Rivera, former Speaker Melissa Mark Viverito, and more coming up. We'll be right back. You're listening to The People's Guide to Power, a new election season call-in show on WNYC. I'm Bridget Bergen, your host, and I'm speaking with State Senator Gustavo Rivera, and we're talking about the close ties between New York, Puerto Rico, and the issues related to Latino power. And I want to go straight to Therese, who is calling from Aguas Buenas in Puerto Rico. Is that correct, Therese?
Yes. I'm here in Aguas Buenas, Puerto Rico.
And I think you wanted to tell us about some of the mutual aid happening there, which goes to, you know, Senator Rivera, your point about finding people on the ground doing the work.
Thanks. First, I want to say gracias to Gustavo Rivera for like clearing up like some of the misconceptions about what is happening on the island in terms of like LUMA and the infrastructure and the crumbling infrastructure that we've been dealing with. And also highlighting the fact that it is a colony and the privatization that is constantly impacting our lived reality every day. So that's one point that I wanted to, you know, bring up. And thank you again, Gustavo, for clearing up John's misconceptions about what's happening. Let's see. So my name is Tariq Iriarte Medina. I am from Brooklyn by way of Arecibo, Puerto Rico, and I'm Afro-Puerto Rican. And I've been diligently working in the community under my project, Soul to Soul Freedom Project, to bring mutual aid relief efforts to the pueblo of Loíza, specifically Mini Mini Villa Cristiana and Merene Alta. In those sectors, I have a severe mosquito infestation from the floodwaters that came into the homes there where babies and elders live. So I'm currently trying to get 1,500 mosquito nets to that particular community because people are being infected, have infections, and also being hospitalized. Also, there's inconsistent water and electricity. Obviously, the rolling blackouts are still happening, and also rationing of the power in those particular areas. So these are the most vulnerable communities, some of the most vulnerable communities on the island. The South is very much impacted as well.
Therese, can I ask you, do you is there a website or a link that you can you know, tell our listeners now so that they can help you raise money for these mosquito nets?
Yes, Taller Salud. You can put Tyrese. They can send, if they want to order them online and ship them to Puerto Rico, they can send them to Taller Salud, who is a community partner who's helped me distribute them, and just mark them as Soul to Soul Freedom Project mosquito nets as in the care of.
Great.
And then or Taller Salud's website, and just make sure that demarcation is there so we get it to the right areas.
Therese, thank you so much for calling. I think this is exactly, we want to empower our listeners to be able to actually help. And Senator, I want to thank you so much for your time. You know, we have to wrap up our segment now, but I'm so grateful you've been able to join us this morning and provide a lot of perspective, both on what's happening here in our region, but also your experience helping Puerto Rico and the community as you've done in your work since then. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Thank you for covering this. And hopefully we can come back and talk about it some more at some point.
Absolutely. I'm Bridget Bergen. You're listening to The People's Guide to Power. And when we come back, former Speaker Melissa Mark Viverito offers her perspective and analysis. Stay with us. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to The People's Guide to Power, our new midterm election pop-up show. Thanks for joining us here in week four. I'm Bridget Bergen, and my next guest is another trailblazing Latina. Melissa Mark Viverito was the first Latina elected city council speaker, a citywide post, which she used to raise the visibility of issues like criminal justice reform, as the first to call for the closure of Rikers Island. She also focused on bringing greater support to immigrant New Yorkers with funding for legal services and programs like IDNYC. Speaker, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Bridget.
Speaker, I know you have family in Puerto Rico now. I'm wondering, what has the recovery been like so far?
Lackluster, to put it mildly. It is really an affront that we continue to be repeating the mistakes of the past. You think that with prior challenges and prior circumstances like Hurricane Maria, we would have learned the lessons. And I've been saying that this is the living embodiment of insanity, of basically going through the same motions and same actions over and over again, expecting a different result. The fact that we have portions of the island that are still 50% without electricity, other parts maybe 20%. You know, we have the president coming tomorrow to visit. Mm-hmm. It's just unacceptable, right? There are billions of dollars in the pipeline that were designated after Hurricane Maria. Some of us who are advocating for Puerto Rico are asking for that money, one, to be able to be applied towards Fiona relief efforts. But two, when we speak specifically about the infrastructure and the grid and the electricity, that money be invested solely in renewable sources. The only way that we're going to overcome this reality in Puerto Rico is by supporting renewable sources of energy. And there have been many coalitions on the ground, community-based, community-led, that have provided very tangible solutions on how to move forward. The reality, though, is that government, whether it's the central government in Puerto Rico or whether it's the federal government, have not invested in those community-led and community sponsored solutions. That is what we need. We need the voices of the people to be at the decision-making table. We have the voices, we have the solutions. And so it is about Congress giving us the power because we have the tools, right? And when I say power, I'm talking about the money. Money needs to be directly invested in these community-led responses. It is not through basically allowing the central government to politicize how these monies are going to be spent. So that is a really tangible solution.
I want to invite our listeners to join us. And Abraham, who is from Jersey City. Welcome to WNYC.
Hello.
In the People's Guide to Power.
Yes, yes, okay. First things first, I'm from Puerto Rico, born and raised in Bayamón, Loma Verde. Moved here recently in 2019, searching for a job that I could eventually transfer, and thank God I got hired by the post office. So looking forward to going home. And, well, I'm calling because, you know, it's really frustrating, everything that is happening. I was there when Maria happened, and, you know that movie when people die and they wake up and they do the same thing every day? You know what it is to do the same thing every day for like 3-4 months because you only had the sunlight to do to the day, and then that's it. You go to sleep, nothing else. No electricity, no water. And the part that I used, that my mom lives, that where I used to live, we only get water by the pump. So if the pump doesn't have water, electricity, I don't have water. So it's frustrating, everything is happening, and it's a lot of layers because it starts from government, starts from that we're still a colony. The Act Jones is the worst thing that can happen, and I can't believe they haven't took it out. Like the fact that we as an island who are in the middle of nothing, but we have so many things close to us, you know, I'm sorry if I get emotional, but it's hard because, like, you know, how long does it take from coming from Florida all the way to Puerto Rico? Help, right? Because we're an island, remember, boats. Instead of coming from Colombia, coming from other islands, but everything has the Act Jones. Look, Act Jones. Everything has to go through U.S. You get it? Like, if Santo Domingo want to help us, they got to send everything to Tallahassee to get in a U.S. boat to go back down.
So, Abraham, I want to jump in. I want to just jump in real quickly. No, I'm so grateful you called, and I appreciate what you're sharing, but because we are a local politics show, I have to take it over to the question. Do you think about these issues when you are looking at candidates? Do you, you know, expect them to have a position on things like the Jones Act when you go to vote, or, you know, do you ask their office and try to hold them accountable?
So my thing is that the corruption is so big in Puerto Rico that sometimes you feel like you are worth, you know, like you're doing nothing by voting. Like at the end of the day, they do whatever. Like how many protests we already had in Old San Juan against Luma from day one, before they even signed that horrible contract. Like if you look up the contract of Luma, you will see how bad it is. And they still did it because it's all about politics and money, you know, and the corruption in Puerto Rico is so big that it's super hard for us to move forward unless the U.S. step in, right? But also, there's a lot of people who doesn't want that. There's people who want to make their own choices. So it's a tough situation. Like I said, this is onions. And it's layers and layers and layers to it.
Abraham,
I mean, as me being outside, I always try to go and promote what I'm telling you. When I see groups of activists in Puerto Rico, I'm telling them, hey, we got to go to Congress. We got to push for something to happen. Get rid of the Act Jones or either we stay or we are something else. We're going to keep going after colony because this is what's happening.
Abraham, thank you so much for calling. We really appreciate hearing from you. Wow, Speaker, that's a lot there. Do you want to respond to any of that?
Well, I mean, I think, look, it's hard for me not to get emotional hearing Abraham getting emotional, right? My mother lives in Puerto Rico. My mother is aging, right? So the issue of Puerto Rico is very, very important to me. But when you talk about localizing this, right, this is why leadership matters. This is why we need our public officials in office to be visible. Not only talking about working behind the scenes. No. We need visibility and us using our voice and our platform to talk about the injustice and the inequity that exists. We need to be inspired. We need to be given hope. So when we elect people to office as Latinos, as Puerto Ricans particularly, I do expect them to be in front of those mics. I do expect them to be using their platform to speak about the injustice that we're living in Puerto Rico, because you know what? The federal government has a role to play. And we can talk about what kind of change is needed at the federal level to try to bring justice to Puerto Rico. So when we talk about the lack of Latino leadership that is elected, of coalescing, of being firm, of utilizing their voice to talk about the fact that for the first time in how many mayoral administrations, this mayor did not select a Latino deputy mayor when we're 30% of the city of New York. If we're not coalescing as Latino leadership to say that the state Democratic Party must have Latinos in executive leadership, which they do not. When we can't be taken seriously, right? As a community, me raising my voice now as not someone in office, but as someone who lives in the city of New York, to say the levels of power need to reflect our reality as a community in this city. So I cannot be taken seriously. Others cannot be taken seriously if our leadership is not flexing that political muscle on our behalf. And this is very important. So, you know, there are, yes, you know, the senator was talking about these fiefdoms that are developed. We cannot be electing ourselves just to position ourselves. This is about positioning ourselves on behalf of a greater community that we represent. Because if you're getting elected to office by saying, hey, I'm a woman or I'm a Latina, I'm going to be the first Latina in my community, then you know what? Then you have a responsibility to those communities as well. When we founded 21 and 21, we demonstrated, right, that it was not only about electing more women to office, but also how do we utilize now the positions that we have available to us as elected officials,
and let's just
chiefs of staff, et cetera, to help develop that leadership, right, of other women, so that the door is open for others and we're not closing it behind us.
And I would just, for our listeners who are not familiar with 21 and 21, that of course is an organization that you were one of the co-founders of that sought to elect at least 21 women to the city council in 2021. You exceeded your goals and have rebranded. Is it the new
majority?
The new majority. So I think that speaks to what happens when you organize around power. We could clearly keep this conversation going, but we have to leave it there for now. Thank you so much, former Speaker Melissa Mark-Viverito, for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Bridget, for the invitation, and good luck.
Welcome back to the show. You're listening to The People's Guide to Power. It's week 4 of our pop-up elections call-in show. I'm Bridget Bergen, and right now I am thrilled to welcome two veteran journalists who both cover city and state politics and have reported specifically on the role of Latino voters and elected officials in our region. Happy Sunday, friends, to WNYC's David Cruz and to Deborah Lee Santos of the Manhattan Times and the Bronx Free Press. I'm so glad to have you with us.
Hey,
thanks,
good morning.
Thanks for having me on.
Deborah Lee, you covered the mayor when he came back from his trip to Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic earlier this week. What were your impressions of that event? Did he say something to you about his administration's understanding of the needs of those communities and how they're felt here in the city?
Yeah, I think that for anyone who either tuned in on the spot in real time or had the opportunity to listen later, there is no denying that the mayor understands that he's got a nexus to the Latino community in the city. It, in fact, was part of the coalition that propelled him to elected office in City Hall. And he has been very clear, decidedly so, in making those connections known, whether it's specifically with the Puerto Rican community and the Dominican community. Many of the leaders of those respective constituencies stepped up early and identified him as their chosen candidate. And he's been very quick to repay the the tributes, if you will, both in deed and in word. I mean, you can only just listen to him during, for example, the various celebrations that he is wont to attend throughout the city, specifically in the last few weeks with Hispanic Heritage being in full swing. And even just privately, you will hear him say, "I am one of you. You are me," when he speaks to, I know a lot of ethnic groups, but the ones specifically in the groups I've been in, he speaks specifically to that conversation that was about his candidacy and the fact that they saw in him purportedly an extension of someone committed to their priorities. Sure. I did want to say, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I did want to say that you know, there is something to be said for that conversation where a local elected leader, an executive local elected leader, makes a decision to sort of step outside the geographic boundaries of the city or the state and visit a country. And there is, I think, beyond the cynicism, there is not just the virtual signaling, but there is a real conversation to be had for the validity of that presence. I mean, Melissa Marco-Rurrito spoke a few moments ago about the visibility that needs to be flexed. And if that particular leader is not Latino, is not, for that matter, Pakistani, for example, when you speak to the catastrophic floods that are taking place in that region, but they choose specifically to delve into that moment, I don't know that we can dismiss it simply, again, as virtue signaling, given the fact that we are applauding Joe Biden and others in his administration, and for that matter, applauded to a certain degree Donald Trump making the visit. There is something to be said for someone caring enough to show up and be present, however manufactured and calibrated that visibility is. We do seek that, and we need to be clear about that reality.
But I want to just, and then do you get the sense, and we only have in our short segment here, do you get the sense that there's anything about his policy agenda that is actually resonating among the Latino voters and communities that you cover, or, you know, maybe that is turning them off? And in particular, I'm wondering about the reaction to how the city is treating the asylum seekers who are being bused here to the city.
Yeah, that's a really complicated issue, Bridget, and I regret that we have such a limited time. I know that these are all really no, and I applaud you and the staff for putting this together, just be able to sort of start to dip our toe into it. But the fact of the matter is that you know, Warsonshire, forgive me, the British Somali poet has often said that home is the mouth of a shark, you know, and I'm paraphrasing poorly, you know, when you need to leave it. No one leaves their home, and we're reminded of this when havoc is brought to our shores, for those of us that are from any of these places impacted, including, for that matter, Florida. No one leaves because they want to necessarily. This is a question of really the desperate need, and you're seeing that in these migrant communities, and the idea that everyone is sort of in this same space for competing resources, and for that matter, for competing attentions of the mayor, I think frankly does a disservice to the larger conversation about what the city can do. And frankly, I would ask us, as we look at this matter, through what prism we're choosing to sort of position ourselves, because I would argue that he's stepping into a vacuum in which the state, and specifically our other local executive leader, the governor, has been perhaps less vocal and less visible on all of these matters.
I want to jump in because I want to get David into this conversation. David, you've also looked at the potential power of the Latino vote in the city. It was certainly something that we were paying really close attention to in last year's mayoral primary, projections about Latino voters, that they could be the decisive voting bloc. But analysis from political analyst Eli Valentin, a lecturer at Union Theological Seminary and columnist at Gotham Gazette, found that only about 17% of Latinos went to the polls last June, and the borough with the highest Latino population had actually the lowest voter turnout of Latino voters, the Bronx, a borough that you reported on for a long time, with just 14%. Does that surprise you, given the conversations you've had with voters?
Yeah. So does that surprise me? I'm leaning towards no, because I think there's a serious voter turnout problem in the Bronx writ large, and it's been going on for decades. On the other hand, if we're speaking about last year's citywide elections, one reason you saw so few Latinos come out and vote is because there was no serious Latino contender on a citywide race, specifically for mayor. And, you know, we had Diane Morales, who was a who ran in the primary, but she struggled to gain traction and might have missed an opportunity to galvanize more Latino voters. And, you know, it kind of, you know, when I look back about that on that race, it makes me wonder, you know, what would have happened if someone like Ruben Diaz Jr., who was the Bronx Borough president, had actually ran for mayor. He initially was thinking about it, but he decided that he did not want to run for it. And he might have had a little bit more political juice. And I think, like, when a Latino voter is sort of, like, looking at, like, who's on the ballot, they would definitely be leaning more towards someone who might speak the language, who might actually have the same sort of, like, life experience, you know. But, and so I kind of feel as if that was one reason why you saw just so few Latino voters just come out. But, you know, there is an open secret from the time I've been covering politics, and it's that elected officials, once they're in power, they really don't want people voting in high numbers, and they simply want their base to vote. So it's a mistake to think elected officials are invested in kind of this get out the vote strategy, since that might make them vulnerable. So,
David,
that also is a very complex issue, but that I hope that answered it.
No, it was great. And I thank you both so much. David, I have one more question for you, and we have about a minute or so for you to answer it. You've been paying a lot of attention to redistricting, especially at the city council level now, and talk about, you know, the way we move power. Just briefly, where are we in that process? What are we going to see coming this week? And what districts are on your radar in terms of shifting Latino power in the city?
Yeah, so the commission is essentially done with their work. They had two hearings. Really, they weren't just hearings. They were really just meetings in which the public was able to actually see how the actual map-making process happened, which I thought was extremely extraordinary. Now, it all comes down, as you mentioned, to the commission convening once again to vote this upcoming week on whether to release the maps to the city council for kind of like an advisory review. And if the council accepts, then the maps are submitted to the clerk's office for review. If not, then it triggers a whole new set of hearings where the public will once again decide, you know, the look of these maps. And to your question on where specifically we're looking at with regards to, like, Latino power, I think a lot of the action is really, like, concentrated in Deborah Lee's area of, you know, the northern area of the Bronx, I think, Manhattan, where, you know, they want to essentially keep, you know, the Latino population in one specific community to ensure that their political power is maintained. So that is something I'm looking at. Perhaps, you know, I'm guessing that the commission might actually indeed vote on it this time out.
Yeah, I wish we could go on longer, but we're going to have to leave it there with Deborah Lee Santos of the Manhattan Times and Bronx Free Press. And my colleague, WNYC's David Cruz, editor of the People in Power Desk. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bridget.
That's it for today's show. If you want to go back and listen to any of the conversations you've heard today, you can find them at wnyc.org/guide to power. You can also hear our series in the podcast feed for The Brian Lehr Show. I'm Bridget Bergen. Thanks for listening. Join us next Sunday and at noon and every Sunday through the elections in November for The People's Guide to Power.
That was this week's edition of The People's Guide to Power. If you want to hear it live, you can tune in to 93.9 FM and AM 820 WNYC, or live stream it at WNYC.org every Sunday at noon through the midterm elections in November. Until next week, thanks for listening.